Well, let's get started. My name is Arpan Shah. I run product marketing for Azure Infrastructure. And I have the honor to be the moderator today to ask and help ask questions to this expert panel. We have experts across Microsoft, as well as the industry. And in just a minute, you'll get to hear about them. Now, while they are stars in their field, in order for the session to be amazing, I encourage all of you to kind of step up to the mic, ask some amazing questions, and if you ask a really hard question, I think there's a prize in it for you. So let's make this really interactive. Prize in it for the audience, not for the panel, just to be clear. So with that, I'll just start with a quick intro, and we'll start with Corey down there.
Sure. Is this just intro? Am I so?
Oh, fun? Intro.
See,
thank you.
I listened to you ahead of the session.
All right. So just about a minute ago, I said...
For about a second.
I'm asking the panel to introduce yourself and share a fun fact, Corey.
Okay, there we go. Got it. So hi, my name is Corey Sanders. I run the compute team in Azure. So this is a VM, serverless, containers, all sorts of fun stuff, infrastructure. I've been in the team since 2009, and I've been at Microsoft for 14 years, actually. And then fun fact, I was actually in, maybe I'll tweet this out. Can I tweet to just this group? I don't know. I was in a band in high school. I was the lead singer and keyboardist for a band, and all we played was Phish songs. We were called Outlet.
That is fun. I'm Tad Brockway. I'm responsible for Azure Storage and Azure Stack. And I've been in Azure since 2011. And my fun fact is that, I just cleared this with Corey. My fun fact is that I love to mountain bike. I broke my neck a few years ago, which was terrible mountain biking. And Corey teased me relentlessly about my neck brace. So that's...
I'm Erica Brush, the co-founder and COO of Bitnami. We create tools for packaging applications for on-prem and cloud deployments. We're a proud partner of Microsoft's. So we've been working with them since 2012, and we will drive over 1 billion hours of cloud compute usage this year through the catalog that we deliver on all the major cloud vendors. I am not nearly as cool as these two guys. I'll share a fun fact that's slightly self-serving, which is in the free time that I don't have, I'm an investment partner out of a fund called X Factor that's focused on funding companies with at least one female founder. So if you know awesome female founders, send them my way.
Very cool. That's actually a cooler fact than anyone else's fun fact. Joshua McKenzie, I'm vice president at Pivotal, also a Microsoft partner, the makers of such wonderful open source things as Cloud Foundry and Spring. Fun fact, I have started tech companies and I did drop out of college, but when I dropped out of college, I did it to start a circus troupe and not a tech company. But the circus thing didn't work out terribly well. No, that was not Pivotal. Nicely done. There was a pivot in there somewhere, yeah.
All right, thank you. So on that note, if you have a question, please come up to the mic. And while people are lining up, I actually have a few questions that I received over the last few days that I've been checking. And I thought I'll start with a couple. So again, please, there are two mics up here. Please queue up. Question for the panel. And anyone can take this. One of the hot topics at Build this year, and just in the industry, is serverless. And so what's the role of infrastructure if development's all about serverless?
I guess because I'm holding the mic, I get the first swing at it. I like to think of development as being when I don't have to think about IP addresses, right? And so ideally, as a developer, I never want to know too much about the infrastructure. But the reality is, if you're building a distributed system, some of your code is probably running on a different server, and there's a network hop in there somewhere. And certainly, if you're writing serverless, or let's call it functions as a service, your functions are probably on different servers. So understanding the network, at least, is a requirement. And we were joking earlier, I don't really care that much about storage. It's important but boring. But networking I care a lot about, because it's important and annoying. So yeah, I'd say infrastructure, understanding the network topology is really critical.
I think I'd say that serverless is incredibly exciting. We have our own serverless project for Kubernetes, so we're heavily invested in this space. But the reality is it takes a long time for things to move over, and infrastructure is still something that you absolutely need to care about. All these wonderful applications that we already have written care about it quite a bit. And so serverless is another tool, but what we see a lot right now is it's being used to glue together different services that do care very much about infrastructure. So infrastructure is not going away anytime soon, but serverless is an important tool for achieving certain things that you want to achieve, or sometimes building new certain services and apps.
Can I defend storage?
You can try.
Okay, I'll take a run at it. But seriously, I do think that the world that we're in is that infrastructure is being transformed, certainly, but serverless combined with traditional infrastructure like storage, that actually is a pretty powerful combination, because you can take all of your assets that are on-prem or even cloud-first assets, and you can pool them into infrastructure and then do interesting things with it without having to write a ton of code and know about IP addresses and all that stuff. So I think that in a way, serverless is really lighting up traditional infrastructure, and so I think these things are highly compatible.
Yeah, I'll add maybe just one thing. Totally agreed. I think if you look at even what we just launched with our Event Grid support with storage, I'll give storage a little bit of a shout out. The last one for the day. Did you say you ran the storage team? Did they all hear that? So if they didn't hear that, they may not have understood the joke. You said okay. Tad runs the storage team. Anyway, so one of the things that we've done is with Event Grid, we've effectively created sort of the ability to launch very simple serverless workflows based on actions happening with storage. And it's the first one that we've launched, but we plan to launch this with a lot of services and solutions, and even directly launching it with other infrastructure that's being deployed. So I think going back to Erica's point, I think the being able to sort of piece these things together with serverless is actually bringing sort of more power and more automation to infrastructure as we know it today, whether they be VMs or containers or even PaaS-based solutions, and being able to sort of add more power and more automation to it. So I actually think that's going to be the way in which serverless is used for a while prior to sort of apps being completely rewritten serverless, which I think is going to be hard. At some point we'll get there, but I think it's going to be hard and take time.
Great. Do I see a question up here? Yeah, go for it.
So what is the value proposition of Azure Stack over something like OpenStack? And do you think that there would ever be a long-term migration plan from OpenStack to Azure Stack?
So I'll take a... Do you want to answer?
I think someone just won the prize. But
I'll take a crack at the first part. The latter part, I think, is something that probably is not something that certainly is on our roadmap by any means. But I would say the simple answer to the first part is that it's really the simplicity and converged nature of Azure Stack, that you can go predefine your config for how it's going to fit into your data center. And then you can go buy a complete converged system from a trusted vendor. The thing shows up, you turn it on, and really within just a few minutes, you can have on-prem cloud. And you get that on-prem cloud with the array of third-party ISV partner solutions from partners like these two that integrate with the public cloud, but also nicely with the on-prem environment. You don't get any of that with anything really that's out there from one of the other vendors.
Thank you so much, Mike. The trolling there, if you didn't realize, is because I was one of the co-founders of OpenStack, so he was like needling very deliberately. thank you for that. I don't really bring it up that much anymore. I mean, there's two things. One, to your point, Cloud Foundry just announced GA support for Azure Stack, and the hybrid cloud story here is that you have the same API experience on-prem and off-prem. Super powerful. And we didn't really see that mature in the OpenStack community. The other challenge really with OpenStack in general is it works reasonably well at massive scale. So there's folks that use it, you know, 50,000, 100,000 VMs. It takes a lot of people to run that. Azure Stack, to your point, can be run by very few people in very small footprints. So when we see customers who want to have dozens or hundreds of points of presence, this is a great pattern for that. They can use Azure Regions where they exist, and they can use Azure Stack where they don't. So that's really pretty powerful.
Yeah, I just wanted to reinforce a couple things. The value prop we find is not just on-prem, but like you said, edge. Like, you can actually have this deployed in different places. And the other thing is consistency. Yeah. So if you're a developer, you're using effectively the same services for Stack as you would for Azure. All right, I think we have another question here.
Sure, not to beat a dead horse, but speaking specifically about storage in Azure Stack, when do we expect to have SAN capabilities added to Azure Stack so that you can have Azure Stack connect to a classic on-site SAN?
A classic on, yeah, totally. So as well as a NAS device, I'm guessing?
No, just SAN.
Just SAN? Okay.
So, iSCSI, Fibre Channel.
So that's something that we're looking at for sure. And we're thinking about, there's a balance between having a system that's a converged system that's super easy and turnkey for really one user to deploy. And then having that integrate with other infrastructure in the customer environment. And so we're in the process of trying to find our way to that right balance. We don't want to go to a place where it sort of defeats the purpose of converged technology, but that is a scenario that we're definitely looking at. Is there a specific use case, just to enlighten me, that is a priority for you?
Sure. So, for instance, I have a 20 terabyte SQL database.
Okay.
And I want to bring that into Azure Stack, but 20 terabytes being eaten out of all the faceplate drives of that Azure Stack, that's a lot of space to eat up, especially if I'm trying to stay all flash.
Okay.
But on my site, I have classic SAN that has many, you know, lots of all flash.
That's right. And you want to take advantage of it.
Yep.
So today, of course, you can have a remote volume on a NAS device that you can mount in, but that might not give you the perf that you're looking for that workload.
Right.
Is that true? Okay.
Yep.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Vishwas, do you have a question?
Yeah. Sorry, I came in late, so this question may be off base a little bit. But as a cloud developer, I started out an app developer. It was clear that you had to know something about infrastructure to be successful, especially in the enterprise workloads. Right. The one question I have is that developers should care less about infrastructure, but a lot of underlying details leak through. And you know, as a result, you're required to know more. I'll give you an example. If you're setting up API management or you're setting up name a service, Redis Cache, I want to treat both these services are completely PaaS services. I don't have to manage these machines. But at the same time, I have to worry about what ports to open up. And you know, if it's a hybrid scenario, what routes to open up and things like that. So I want to not have to worry about that. But these underlying tech implementation details seem to leak. And I have to care about it. So I don't know if that makes sense. That what is being done to sort of bring consistency across these services? So I just have one policy and just work across these services.
From the Bitnami perspective, like I said, we're a Microsoft partner, and one of the things that we're doing and we think the value that we bring is provide consistently configured, like ready-to-run stacks across all the different environments that you might want to use. So you can go and get Bitnami for your local laptop, and then you can get the same experience in Azure Cloud. We just released a ton of containers for the Azure Marketplace, and you get, yay! And so you get the same experience. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. So we just published a bunch of containers for the marketplace, and the idea is to try to help solve those problems, right? To give you a more consistent experience with things that are already configured out of the box, to give you a great platform on which you can then build and develop your applications. It certainly doesn't solve all the problems, but that's one way that we're looking at trying to facilitate like an easier developer experience.
Yeah, I would just highlight maybe the term cloud is getting gratuitously applied here to be all things that are above API-driven infrastructure. And there's certainly a lot of development going on where you don't have to be aware of infrastructure, right? Most of what happens in the Cloud Foundry ecosystem, we're looking at tens of thousands of developers globally now, not thinking about DNS or IP addresses or storage performance or VMs or even containers. Where the line gets drawn is cases like what your previous questioner was asking about, SQL database, a place where you do have a performance sensitive concern anytime you're talking about a data service. And so the Open Service Broker API project, which Microsoft is a partner with, Pivotal, everybody, Kubernetes is the backbone of this idea of, think of it as like the USB cable of what's now happening and trying to get that abstraction not to leak, right? So you have easy development going on, and then you've got complicated network-sensitive, performance-sensitive development going on. You just want to be able to connect those two things together so you keep the teams that have to care about infrastructure as small as possible and as close to the infrastructure as possible. I think that's working right now. It seems to be working. We've seen certainly in the last year, you can run, you know, crazy cool projects in Kubernetes with a bunch of custom storage drivers and a bunch of, you know, affinity, anti-affinity rules about the containers in the pod, and then connect that through the Service Broker API into Cloud Foundry or into other platform solutions, right? And not care that one team cares deeply about infrastructure and one team doesn't even know where it is. So it's starting to evolve. I mean, you're right. Leaky abstractions are worse than no abstractions at all.
I'll always talk if I've given the opportunity. Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly also work on the services side, right? I think that the and the nature of some of the compute services and the data services, I think, will dictate how much the abstraction can be fully maintained, right? I think when you look at something like SQL Server, there's a lot of assumptions that are built on SQL Server about having the ability to configure and change and tweak and so on with sort of the core infrastructure, and so it's hard to fully abstract that away without it being a breaking change. But when you look at something like, you know, I think, again, going back a little bit to the serverless side, something like Functions or something like Logic Apps, you know, even Event Grid, like what that's running on, what OS that's running on should be mostly abstracted away. But even there, it's challenging because, you know, we are working on Linux support for Functions, which you're sort of like, well, why would you have to do that? It's Functions. It shouldn't matter. Well, turns out Java runs a lot better on Linux than it does on Windows, right? And so we've gotten a lot of feedback of like, hey, your Java support on Functions doesn't run as well as it could. And so the problem is that some of these abstractions are impossible to fully separate just given the history of these existing services and solutions that people are writing to. If you write to Java, unfortunately, we do have some need to expose what it's running on because just the history of Java and where it runs well. So.
Can I just
a follow-up question.
Quick, sorry. I apologize. So
he didn't like my answer.
I liked your answer, but are we saying that, you know, the serverless infrastructure is essentially shared infrastructure is at loggerheads with any of the enterprise requirements which require network isolation and things like that? I mean, you can go one way, serverless, I don't have to worry about anything, I'll just drop the code, I don't care how the traffic gets routed, I'll use. But then you have this network isolation challenges that many of the compliance regimes dictate on you. Are you seeing that the two things at loggerheads?
I mean, I think the beautiful part about virtualization of the network is that you can separate your infrastructure without having to have separate infrastructure, right? So you can basically offer, and we do it on storage, we do it on compute, we do it on network, right? You can virtualize everything, and you can give people the abstraction and the isolation that they need to meet their compliance requirements, but without actually having to say you're fully dedicated. I mean, the natural extreme of saying you're fully dedicated means they're running on a single machine that's their own entire network and their own entire storage. It's just that's not cloud anymore, right? And so there's a little bit of it's kind of finding that spot in between. And then there's the high-level services that actually add even more capability to do that, which I think you probably want to talk about now. Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing a lot of different approaches get used in different industries. So if you take PCI compliance and you compare it to, say, DoD regulation ICD 503 or something, they'll take a different approach to isolation. Some of those are, you know, a fully separate data center. Some of them, it's network virtualization. Some of them in Cloud Foundry, it's using isolation segments, or it's using, you know, organizations and spaces and sort of higher order tenancy. In the Pivotal Kubernetes product, PKS, we just give out separate Kubernetes clusters. And part of this is where you put automation. If you can get a cluster on demand, it's and get rid of it on demand, it's easy to say, great, every team take your own cluster. We don't need to share them. Serverless, I'm waiting to see. There's still so many projects in that space. Like, we've got Riff. There's a bunch of open source community stuff happening on top of Kubernetes. There's a bunch of approaches of where do you draw the tenancy line? Which things are shared and which things are not? And I think the reason is because these, if we squint and we say, well, it's all compliance, that's actually a simplification. It's really which compliance program, in which country, managed under which regulations, for which classes of threat. GDPR is one problem, right? Very, very different than saying, hey, it's the Air Force. They have a different approach.
All right, thank you. Yes?
So I'm an infrastructure guy, and it scares me a lot with the power of automation because it reminds me of Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. When I think about something like Azure SQL Database and a P15 SKU, which is $20,000 a month, and then developers take their best practices for fixing bugs into the cloud, and they make multiple copies of this P15, they do some regression, and then they go on vacation. Or you see things like Cosmos DB, right? In your last session, you show Cosmos DB with checkboxes for different regions, and you can just check, and your bill goes ding, 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 and your bill just skyrockets, right? And as developers have access to infrastructure as code, it's really powerful, but that responsibility element is really hard to manage. How do you think about that?
Oh, you all.
I guess. Here we go. We clearly need tools from great partners, like you. Turbometric.
Am I saying it?
Turbonomic.
Yeah.
I suck at that name, and we've been working together for like months. No, I think there's an opportunity to enable the sort of a layer of policy on top, right? And I think that you can do that layer of policy and that layer of control either at the infrastructure layer. So in the Azure side, you can control who can do what, how much they can do. You can put controls and cost-based metrics on it, and alerting and so on to be able to sort of guide you and control you and so on. I think we're just getting at the beginning of policy controls. I think policy will really expand out to offering a lot more granular capabilities and much more intelligent based policy. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for the policy systems to get a lot smarter and then integrate with partner solutions, right? And I do think that's going to be really important for partner solutions that are very good at sort of understanding the true cost of what's being spent and how it's being spent, and then partner solutions that are basically running PaaS-based services and container-based services and so on, and how that integrates in as well, because oftentimes they have their own policy systems that sit on top, and so how do you kind of play all those together? So I do think there's a lot of room for all of this to kind of come together. Today it is, I call it primitive, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for great solutions like Turbonomic. Good. Anyone else? Or after that
stumbling. I'm just going to disagree with you just because it's fun. The only good policy is a dead policy, right? By which I mean, as a developer, I never want to see them. I want them invisible. So I agree that they need to mature, but I think they mature by disappearing. And I'll give you a specific example. In the Cloud Foundry world, capacity is managed in two places, right? The container auto-scaling stuff happens in developer land, but the infrastructure auto-scaling happens in operations land, in the Bosch world. So you really allocate capacity as an operations team, say, here's how much of Azure is going to be available to these different teams, and the developers consume out of that, but without having to think about a policy grammar. There's no can I request or authorize or think about an entitlement. So the grammar is very developer-centric, and just becomes part of the open service broker, or it becomes part of when you push an app and how many gigs of RAM you're requesting. You're not saying, oh, do I need an authorization? So I love great policy. I just don't ever want to think about it. Yeah, I don't want to see it.
Thank you.
All right, good question. So great dialogue on serverless, hybrid. We also talked about governance. I have a question for this panel, just switching up gears. AI. You can't not watch TV and hear about AI. AI is a big theme at the conference as well. So if you're a developer, like, how do you approach AI? There's infrastructure, there's services, there's so much out there. Any advice?
No, I said this is the one topic that I'm probably not great.
I'll take the pivotal way approach here for a second, which is, you know, we're hyper opinionated about always starting with business value. We have no interest in capability for the sake of capability. So say what useful thing could you try doing with AI? And it almost always starts with a chatbot, right? It's like, let's put an interface in front of a user where they can get some value out of it. Or it starts with things like vision and image recognition. It's really, really easy to take cognitive services from Azure and expose them through a service broker into Cloud Foundry and let developers go try and build things. I'm much more interested in using the business value to figure out what kinds of AI then you need, rather than going to try and build AI with an imaginary use case in the future. So everyone says, TensorFlow. Let's start with TensorFlow, and we can run it in containers, and we can put it on Azure Edge. And I'm like, okay, but what are you putting in the model? You know, we work with a lot of the autonomous vehicle companies who have a real use case. The real use case is keep the car in the right part of the road at the right speed. So it's easy then to work into, okay, well, where do we need the model to run, and how fast does it need to perform, and how much data does it take to train it, and what's the workflow for how often we're refreshing that model? Because there's a use case. So I don't, and then you stop even thinking about it being AI. You're just like, well, no, it's this autonomous vehicle problem that we're solving, and we're using whatever tools are appropriate. I don't know, I'm not an infrastructure up guy, I'm a problem down.
I agree, that makes sense. I think there is an opportunity for infrastructure, though, to evolve in a very unique way when it comes to the edge and the cloud with respect to AI. So if you look at the on-prem as being at the other side of the edge or at the edge, by extending your infrastructure from on-prem into the cloud, you can do very interesting things. And so some of the scenarios that we're enabling are the ability for you to drop your data into an edge environment, have that in our platform and with partners, have that tier into the cloud, that data. AI models can be developed, algorithms can be trained from within the cloud and brought back to on-prem. And so that sort of dynamic fluidity across your workloads on-prem to the edge to the cloud, these are very unique areas of business opportunity ahead of us. And there are specific use cases right now, but I think a lot more will emerge. And thinking about the power of your existing data sets and your existing infrastructure as an opportunity to unlock that and open up new areas of insight and even monetization, that's some powerful stuff that's headed our way.
Great. Thank you. I think we have a question here.
So as we go through and democratize AI, models are becoming less difficult to understand and easier to produce with the advent of transference learning, which is the ability to layer models on top of each other to kind of grow the model into more than it was originally designed. What are your thoughts on, you know, marketplaces for models or versioning models as software artifacts, right? As we go through this, how do we take a model and move it along in the future, but, you know, go back if we find that it's, you know, overfit or something like that?
So can I take a little bit of a crack at this? I think that the opportunity there is really limitless. I would say that and this is our philosophy, just to focus on storage and then kind of come back to edge in a second. What we believe is that our vision is to essentially drive the cost of storage down to zero so that you can keep your data sets in the cloud, and then over time you can improve your models, because the technology is going to evolve as well. The technology around AI is going to get better and better, and probably at an exponential rate. And so the way that we think about this is it's critical that we give our customers the ability to drop all of your data sets and get to a place where you just never have to throw anything away, because why would you? It costs you nothing to keep it around, essentially. And then over time, that can be refined as the tech improves, your models can get better. You can resurrect data sets that are very cold and kind of bring them back in, retrain your models, and then let those data sets go back to sleep, I guess, down into the coolest tier of storage. Again, this is the power of infrastructure. So if you think about infrastructure in that sort of a way where you're not boxed into the old ways, sort of the on-prem to traditional IT way of thinking about it, it really opens up all sorts of opportunities, especially when you intersect with new things like serverless and AI.
Excuse me. One thing I'd say relative to that is thinking about licensing. So I think this idea of sharing data sets and models is incredibly interesting. But there's a number of projects going on that I think are super important to help understand and apply licensing to data sets and data models, just like we do to open source software. Because if we don't, what's going to happen is people either don't know how or if they can use or contribute. So we really need a framework just like we have for software for thinking about this data and how it can be shared so we're not hampering, you know, the advancement of all the collaboration. Because like you said, the potential is limitless, but there are some certain pieces that I think are still missing from the ecosystem that need to be figured out before we can really move forward.
There's also some interesting prior art if you look at sort of the scientific community, right? So I ran a program for the World Bank some years ago called the Global Earthquake Model, where we, and it was pre what we would call AI today. So this is more traditional stochastic hazard mapping. But we had the same challenge of there's 400 scientists with different algorithms. They all care deeply about whether their algorithm gets used and how much, and the derived sort of version history and provenance of the model matters because whole countries plan, you know, investment around it. So we used Git. We just put everything into Git repos, and we looked at, you know, the history of the models as they evolved, the publications, who derived their model from whoever else's model. And kind of honestly, Git's a great tool, even in places where people don't think of applying it, like this issue of license and ownership. You can take things like the Creative Commons licensing framework and look at some of these more questions. Well, what if it's not just open source and free, but what if it's actually commercial? How do you still look at attribution and provenance? I'd say I think that's where we're going with this.
That's a good answer. Do we have another question? If not, I have one for the panel. How many people here are work with Linux in some way or the other? Okay, quite a few. So with that, Erica, I guess I'll ask you. So there are a bunch of people, at least half the folks here work on Linux. Mm-hmm. What do you think of Linux? What are your
Linux
tips on Linux?
Great.
Linux on Azure. What are your tips on Linux on Azure?
No, so I'd say a few things. I think without being too overly kind to our wonderful partner, Microsoft, I've been honestly shocked at how quickly Microsoft's stance on Linux and open source has changed over the last several years. Like you go back 5 or 7 years and I might have said, no way, right? Like go elsewhere. But I think it's very clear, not only from like rhetoric, but from the actions that Microsoft's taken to support not only Linux, but open source in general. I mean, it's pretty dramatic, right? I don't remember what the latest public figures for Linux usage on Azure are. I'm sure greater than 40%. Yeah, and trending upwards pretty massively from what I understand. So it's very clear to me as a partner that works across a number of different product teams that Microsoft is investing incredibly heavily in Linux and the open source ecosystem. And I think, you know, that's further evidenced by things like the acquisition of Deis and all of the amazing Kubernetes talent that you've brought into Microsoft over the last several years. Like there's very clearly a significant investment and the tooling is good. Like you have AKS and you have ACI and you have all these amazing new services coming out. I think like you don't need to hear it from me because the platform almost speaks for itself at this point. I mean, there's more work to do, but it's very clear if you look at the products and services that are available there. And I think you just had an announcement with Red Hat today too, right? So. You know, there's a ton of momentum, and it's continuing to build.
I'm going to take a quick one. For actually a talk I did earlier this morning, I talked a little bit about the progression of Microsoft when it comes to open source, and I found a documentary actually that I would recommend if folks have time. You should never work on slides like when you're super tired and know you have to get them done before the next day because it means any video distracts you. And so I just started watching this documentary, but it's called Revolution OS. Has anyone seen this? Yes. Oh, it's an amazing documentary because it was just super anti-Microsoft, which is just but it was like the clips of, and this is definitely before my time, but it was so hard to believe that this was the same world that we live in. There was like protesting inside Microsoft offices, like people were like going and like ransacking people's offices inside Microsoft's campus because we were so mean with Windows. I mean, it was like nuts to see this sort of world, especially given sort of the world that we live in. Again, it was before my time. I just didn't really realize that this actually was what the world was like, and it sort of said to myself, "Oh, maybe it makes sense why people don't like me very much." It turns out it has nothing to do with that; it's other things. But anyway, I think it's a pretty exciting opportunity that we've. I mean, just candidly, the opportunity that we've been given, somewhat for a second chance, right? When I sort of look at the sort of where we are now with partners like those up here, with partners like Red Hat, and I can remember actually showing up at Red Hat when we started the negotiation with them for the very first time, and it was very interesting because obviously we had a long history with, you know, sort of not really getting along with Red Hat. And it was the week before the Super Bowl. It was in Boston, and it was the Seahawks were playing the Patriots. And so I show up, and I'm walking into Red Hat's office, and I think the receptionist was wearing a Patriots jersey, and I was like, now I have two reasons I don't like you. But it turned out really only one, the Patriots jersey, because just the partnership really, really blossomed from there. So I look at the community, and I look at the opportunities that we've been given to engage, the opportunities for people to let us in and sort of work as part of these communities. It's been wonderful, and I think hopefully there's a lot more that we have to give as part of this engagement.
And you know, the one thing I'll add, Todd, do you have a couple things you want to say? The one thing I'll add is, how many people saw Satya's keynote? The first, I think, few words out of his mouth was like, Bill, Apple, and stock. Right? Again, just talking about the openness of this company, it's pretty pretty incredible how much investment we made and the momentum we're seeing. Ted, did you want to add something? Okay. All right.
Microsoft loves Linux.
You just get ready. Microsoft loves Linux. Jordan, do you want to say something?
Can I ask a question?
Sure, yeah.
Sure. Hey guys. I'm thinking about each of you as a consultant in your area of expertise, and if I'm your customer, help me think about, like, how would you advise me? What would you want to understand about me before you started, like, giving me advice about Corey for compute and Tad for storage? And, like, how would you attempt to understand where I'm coming from before you said, all right, what kind of questions would you ask?
So you're saying, what would I ask to understand what you want to use?
To get to know me, to understand, as my compute consultant, before I start answering your question, I got to know some stuff about you and those questions to help you get to where you need to be.
Is this like over dinner or cocktails or?
Sure.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. Yeah, yeah.
Candlelight. Yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, so I can start. It's actually probably good to hear perspective from everyone here because I do think it's probably different from where, based on where we are and sort of the stack and the services that we run. You know, I think my biggest question or conversation with you would be the focus on what is your journey to modernization, right? I think, a lot of things that we build and focus and work on is, one, how to get your infrastructure deployed, how to get things that you're running currently to be able to run in this cloud environment, this agile environment, but then also how are you modernizing? What parts of your service and solutions are you leaving bits of the infrastructure behind, right? What parts of your service are you containerizing, right? What parts of your servicing are you building new and pulling down from a pre-built container, right? What parts are you then moving to serverless-based solutions? So for me, it really is about what's the journey that you want to go on. And so much of that is app by app. It's not even customer by customer. It's I'm a customer and I've got 100 apps. These 5, I really want to go take in this direction. These 95, I'm just going to move on to VMs or containers, and I'm going to be okay with that for now, right? And so a lot of that is kind of learning, I think, how that shapes out for you.
So for storage and for stack, getting a sense for what are your accountabilities? Like, what is your... There's a phenomenon that's happening where the expectations on folks who are in the trenches, either writing apps or managing infrastructure, their accountability we see is going up because of all of the enthusiasm and momentum and top-down directives having to do with cloud. And so getting a sense as to how can we work together to make it possible so you can get started in transforming some of your existing assets while at the same time starting to unlock some of that unique value in the cloud. One of the things that I love about storage is that for on-prem, for folks who manage storage infrastructure on-prem, it's sort of an unlikely opportunity in a way for those folks to lead into the cloud. So there's opportunity there as on-prem SAN technology and renewals for on-prem gear come up to take that existing infrastructure, transform it to the cloud, and extract all kinds of new interesting value without a lot of work. And so this is an inflection point for infrastructure that can take people who manage infrastructure and turn them into some of the heroes in IT with respect to transformation. So that's the kind of thing I would, assuming it were an IT person, an infrastructure person that I was working with, that's how I would approach things.
I'm gonna steal from something Josh said earlier and focus on the why, right? Like the first thing I would wanna understand is why are you thinking of moving to the cloud? What problems are you trying to solve? Are you trying to save money? Do you have a mandate to shut down your data center, which many do? Are you trying to move faster? Is this about a competitive advantage of some kind? So I think understanding all of that is really critical to then guiding you down the right path. Another thing I'd want to understand is what kind of internal resources do you have, and where do you draw the line on the kind of control versus ease of use spectrum, right? Because with more control, you have more responsibility, as our friend earlier said, and you may or may not care about having control, or you may or may not have the internal resources to actually manage that control well. And kind of where you are in that trade-off and regulations and other things might play into that depending on your business, depends on kind of where in the stack I'd plug you into, as well as your business goals. Like it might be different if you're just trying to save money versus you see, you know, this journey to the cloud is giving you some huge competitive advantage against your competitor. So I need to understand your business and your drivers before I even get to the level of talking about, you know, what services should we be thinking about and where should they run and all of that good stuff.
I think Erica just gave most of the answer I would have given, which was awesome. I'd add one other thing, which is and I wouldn't ask you this directly, but I would try and figure out how willing to change you really are. You know, because a lot of folks are willing to change their tools or they're willing to change some processes, but when they talk about transformation, they really imagine it as a thing that is happening to everyone else in their building and not themselves. And so the mindset shift, the willingness to have a different mindset. I was ranting on Twitter this last weekend about stop thinking about software as a pond and start thinking about it as a river, which is like a weird metaphor. But the specific example is, did you push to prod today? Did you push to prod the first day of the first sprint, right? Are you willing to commit to CD? I actually interviewed at a tech company in 2004 where we were required during the interview to fix a bug, commit to prod, and run the build. And that was the interview process. And the thinking was, if you're not going to do it during the interview, when are you going to do it? Like, if you can't get your mindset into CD, we're not going to hire you. So I don't see a lot of companies starting at that position. And so their journey, like, you'll generally go halfway to as far transformed as you can imagine doing. And if you can't imagine being that radical, you're not going to get anywhere close.
That's good. All right, a question over here.
So my question, so this panel is about why developers should care about infrastructure. And my question is how we can get them to care about it. So I'm a developer. I'll give you a little bit of background that we were using cloud services and we migrated to Service Fabric and we followed an MSDN blog to do that migration. And by the time we were done, we had the secure cluster, the secure network, and a scale set and like 15 different components that all combined together to create our Service Fabric cluster. And by the time we were done, no developer knew anything about networking or about infrastructure. And, you know, we use ARM templates and everything was done and it works, but nobody wants to touch it. People, everybody, when there is any changes we need in that template, people are just pointing each other, you can do it, why don't you do it? I'm the guy who do it. And how can we get all the developers in the team to buy into it? Is there any best practices, any recommendations around that?
Who's doing it while you're not? Well, you're here.
Exactly, no one.
Now I'm nervous.
I have to log in.
I apologize. So I'll touch upon it briefly, and then I suspect Josh probably has something to say. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, I think what I'd probably say is this. I think the setup that's required for you to deploy something like Service Fabric with sort of all those bells and whistles and configurations, the question before sort of leaks the abstractions, right? I mean, I think that it's while Service Fabric is, you know, a great example of a PaaS experience when it comes to the application model, it's not really a PaaS experience when it comes to how it manages the infrastructure. It sort of leaves it kind of halfway up to you, right? And this is the problem that you're sort of raising. This is actually why we just announced this week a new product called Service Fabric Mesh. And this is very specific to your Service Fabric conversation, and then I think the general point will come through, which is intended to be less infrastructure management required to deploy Service Fabric-based applications, right? So the goal here is over time, and there are some services that are better than others, and candidly, Service Fabric's not been one of the better ones here. And this is why I think actually it'd be good to hear from the Pivotal guys after I finish this about Service Fabric, which is the goal sort of is to make it into a much more managed environment where basically all you're thinking about is the app. And you have to configure and decide how you want your network to set up and so on and so forth. But the management of that is really should be taken care of for you by the platform, right? And so that's definitely the right place to be. We have services that do that really, really well. Things like functions we've talked about. Even App Service does that actually quite a bit better than Service Fabric. Service Fabric gives you a lot of power, but then it also comes with that, again, that same responsibility. This is where Service Fabric Mesh is intended to sort of solve that specific problem there. And I do think that's the goal of these platform offerings is to try and find that perfect balance between giving you the control you need without the obligation to have to go manage it in a way that you're uncomfortable, right? And I think that's in some ways that trade-off. Do you want to? Yeah.
I'll give maybe a more specific example. Obviously, I think Cloud Foundry does this super well in terms of keeping the abstraction clean on the operation side and the developer side. And not leaking it, but tunneling it. I gave a talk last year at Redis Conf about the fact that these are two separate teams still inside most orgs, and you can look at sort of site reliability engineering or DevOps and say, do we have rotations? Do we have folks who care a lot about infrastructure but treat it as code and work as part of the dev team? But what I think really helps, if your question specifically is how do you get developers to care, the answer is, require their language and framework to make it make sense to them. So the advantage we have is that we have Spring, right? So from the Pivotal standpoint, we work really well with the Java community. We now are working with Microsoft to bring Spring Framework and Spring Cloud to .NET with Steeltoe. And when you look at Spring, and let's take something like Redis, you say, okay, well, the data structures that you deal with in Spring map directly to things that exist in Redis. And so you have a mental model the developer can comprehend that relates to the infrastructure. And if you look at how they do WAN replication, CRDTs and stuff, they're saying, here's a developer concept that maps directly to something that happens in infrastructure. When it's part of the developer's worldview, they care. So that's why I always start with saying, deploy to prod every day. Start with CI/CD. If the developers, if the first thing they write is their CI pipeline that lands in prod, it's not a, okay, well, we wrote code and then we figured out the infrastructure to run it. It's that we thought of our code as being about the combination of the infrastructure and the code to begin with, and then we apply our mental model of what is our software supposed to do to that intersection iteratively. And you're only consuming the infrastructure that's relevant. So then I guess the question is, if it's not relevant to the developer, if they don't want to know about it, then the platform should deal with it for them. And if they need to know about it, then it should be exposed in an abstraction that makes sense to them. right? And getting that, pushing some of that back on the frameworks and the languages and saying, hey, you have to make this make sense. Things like service discovery. Spring Cloud has a great way of saying, hey, I need to talk to another microservice. I want to address it by name and version, not by URI, because I don't know where it is, and I don't want to know where it is. That's that piece of infrastructure the developer doesn't care about, but they need to care about the name of the service and what version they want to go talk to. And so the language and the framework has exposed that piece of infrastructure of this is a network call. This is not, you know, RPC in process. This is not necessarily on the same host. Those types of abstractions, I think, are the ones that don't leak because they make sense. So you go back to thinking about the design of everyday things or sort of affordances and the Norman, I'm going to forget the name of the book, but you can use literally user experience design on the language concepts to get abstractions that make sense.
All right. By the way, please queue up. The mics are open, so queue up. And in the meantime, I have a question for Corey. Yeah, please go ahead.
I just want to comment on the previous question, which was how do you get developers interested? I think one thing we have found is, you know, I think everybody in the room can agree that automation is key to success in the cloud. And if we do agree to that, then we have to treat our automation code as a first-class citizen. So you have to have good versioning practices, reuse strategy, exception handling, all of that. So, those are all things that developers love and care about, and we need to motivate them to do those things well. I think that's been my sort of tool to getting more developers to writing PowerShell scripts and things like that. So that was a comment to the previous question.
The more you do it, the more often you do it, the better you get at it, right? So if you only run your pipeline once a week or once every 2 weeks, it's always going to be a little scary. It's ceremonial. If you do it for every commit, it's like people get good at using Git because they do it 50 times a day, and then the rebase command isn't terrifying. It's like, oh, I guess I'm changing the history of the universe, but that's okay. I remember learning rebase. Still, I have scars. But when you do it, you know, when it's somebody else's job, I remember the CVS days, or the Perforce days, or the SourceSafe days. Like, source control was scary because we didn't do it very often. You know, once a week we would check code in, and then we never got good at it. So yeah, exactly to your point. I would say it's not just that automation is key to success in the cloud. Automation is key to success, whether in the cloud or otherwise. Yeah.
So I have a question for Corey. Ready? All right. So just switching gears a little bit, one of the benefits of the cloud is being able to do highly scalable, highly available apps. Azure has a ton of features, like you got availability sets, you got a ton, 50 regions, a lot of stuff you talk about. If you're a developer, how do you think of all these features? How do you build a highly available app?
It probably starts with making sure you have all of the right content that you need to deploy, all of the right sort of starting services and a repository for all the right content. And so with that, maybe Erica can explain that a little bit more.
Wow, what a layup that was. One thing that I'll say, actually going back to the previous point on automation though, and then I'll mention that, like I think the difference with cloud, I think automation is key everywhere, but it's not even optional in the cloud. Like the cloud forces automation and containers force it even further, and you'll never be able to keep up without it. And I think that's kind of an important distinction. You could get away without it in the previous environment. In terms of, I think the question was about like how do you think about all these different services and think about building like a highly scalable application? No, it's okay. I'm always happy to talk. My team knows that all too well. I think the way we think about it is we try to provide you with a bunch of different building blocks that you can use to kind of string together different pieces of your app. And you need to look at, you know, each piece of functionality and then look at where does it make sense as a serverless function? Does it make sense as a microserver? Like, how do you kind of put all these different pieces and string them together? And the Bitnami approach to that, obviously, is to provide a cohesive and consistent environment across all the different platforms you might want to run.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, starting with being able to piece those components together, but then also on the platform side, being able to pick which services to use. I mean, this can be a very daunting task, and it's not just first party service. I think that's what's so exciting and sometimes scary is you've got first and third party services that you're picking from and you're piecing them together. And this is where we do try and put things together and sort of offer glue that sort of helps. Josh talked a little bit about one of the glues that we have with the open service broker to sort of enable some third-party platform offerings to be able to call our data offerings in sort of a simple and consistent way. You saw a little bit about EventGrid as sort of one of the other glues that we have. I'm going to stop saying that now. I think I'm done saying glues. One of the other options we have that piece together services that will allow you to take advantage of different parts of the platform in sort of a cohesive and coherent way, and then a lot of the conversation even before about sort of why I think the answers that we heard a little bit before, what are you trying to do and how are you trying to make these changes, and then the services will become more obvious of sort of what you're trying to do. Look, you want a portable service, you want a container-based service. Actually, Kubernetes may make a lot of sense, right? Let's talk about our Kubernetes offering and how you can take advantage of some of the things even Erica talked about to deploy on top of that. You're looking for more of a serverless, function-based offering. Let's talk about that. You want to deploy something to the edge. Let's talk about that. And so a lot of the services are really starting to be geared towards the environment and the outcomes that you're looking for. And really it's just about sort of, again, finding the glue to piece things together. And that's where a lot of the sort of connecting services that we have exist.
Yeah.
No, I think what I'd say, and it goes back to what we were saying before, too, is like, what problem are you trying to solve? And I think that's really important. I mean, it's great as a developer to try new things and to experiment with new services. But if you're actually building an app or service that needs to be maintained, you need to think about why you're doing it and what the purpose is, and not just change the newest, shiniest, latest thing. Because one thing you see, and I think we saw this a lot in the early days of containers too, is like people really overcomplicate things. Like some apps will run just fine in a monolithic kind of single server environment, and you're going to get all the business value that you need out of it. And then we have people trying to like pick apart their apps into 1,000 different services that are all talking to each other because that was, the new hotness. And it's just not practical, right? Again, great for your weekend project. Great to build something cool and to learn about new services. I fully encourage that. But not when it's something that you or somebody else is going to have to keep running over time. Like, figure out what makes sense and then go from there.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm hearing from you guys over the last few questions is don't just gravitate towards buzzwords. Like really think about the business problem. And all of these things may have a very unique solution. There isn't a single answer. I will ask one more question. Earlier in the session, there was a lot of questions on hybrid in one way or the other. I know Tad got a lot of Azure Stack questions. How many people have a hybrid environment that they have to manage? Okay, I'd say about 20%. So I will make a statement. If you're just building a cloud app, you could argue that's simpler. When you have a hybrid environment, there are more considerations. So could you share a best practice based on a customer that you've worked with as they looked at hybrid deployments and development?
I'll share a couple. And I'm going to connect your comment to the previous question, which is this question about HA, right? HA or DR, highly available. People don't define that well, and they just borrow from their disaster recovery plan from the 80s, and then they're like, everything has to be HA. And I was like, okay, well, why and at what cost level? So with our customers, we usually talk about, prod being a thing that has business value, and it's in the real world. Mission critical, right, which is probably we are losing either lots of money or lives if the app is down. And business critical, which is if the app is down, the company ends. So there is company ending software in some cases. It's rare, actually. And so a lot of people talk about gold-plated HA, or they talk about gold-plated hybrid.
And they're saying, well, we got to have hybrid because we got to have this really complex HA story in these certain countries where we have perfectly low latency and perfect uptime. And we're like, okay, fine, but is it actually at that tier? And if it is, here's the best practices piece. The best practices piece, and I'm thinking of a large credit card processor. It's a joint customer with Microsoft and Pivotal. We've done videos with them before. They use a fun, complex hybrid strategy, multiple public providers and on-prem. And that was their first deploy. And I think that actually is the best practice, is if you're going to do hybrid, don't imagine you're going to evolve to it later. Start hybrid. Because the mental model, the shift of, oh, what features am I taking advantage of, and how do my pipelines work, and where does versioning happen, and where do I roll out a blue-green, and are things separated by prod and pre-prod, you have to make all those decisions eventually. It is much easier to actually do them up front and then move forward. You don't have to start with every app in that environment. You can start with a very small amount of true hybrid, but if you're going to do true hybrid, start that way. And then the second piece, I think, is cloud bursting doesn't exist, actually. It was a great, it exists for certain workloads. When people talk about AI, and they're like, we're going to build the model with massive amounts of data in the cloud, and then we're going to run the model on the edge. We're going to export a model and go run it. That works. Bursting works, by which I mean if you've got a workload in a public cloud, and it's seasonal, and you're a retailer, and it's Black Friday, and you have 10x or 30x of the containers running for that one day, that works great. But this idea of going from on-prem to off-prem for a bursty workload, nobody does that. Because the data's got to be there already. If you're either running hybrid, true hybrid, or you're running in one environment or the other, and you're bursting in that place. So that, I think, is the biggest debunk. Is everyone starts to say, we're going to go to hybrid when we need cloud bursting. I was like, okay, there are a lot of people who do bursty workloads using cloud. There's a lot of people doing hybrid. But there's no one using that combination the way we all thought it would play out in the early 2000s.
Sure. So anyway, so I guess with respect to hybrid, there are many variations of hybrid for sure. There's the, and the term hybrid is becoming a little overused and I would say almost even sort of antiquated. Hybrid in terms of being a bridge from on-prem to transforming into public cloud, that's there are a set of patterns around that. But I think increasingly what we'll see is cloud applications and data sets being extended into more edge environments. And so it just depends on kind of where you're coming from in terms of the advice and the patterns. I will say that just to the point about cloud burst, that can work for, and it is for HPC scenarios. It's not for sort of mainstream IT scenarios. But for HPC, we bought a company at the beginning of this year that does just that. You can keep your data on-prem on your NAS appliance and then burst into the cloud. And there are a bunch of customers who are doing that to scale out their compute, but then keeping their data on-prem. And that's in the area of life sciences and autonomous driving and rendering for media and entertainment productions. So these things, I think my hunch is we're going to see more of that kind of a thing over time where the data sets do start to, and compute start to be loosely coupled across edge and public cloud. I think that is a trend.
Any other follow-up questions? It's time.
Oh, by the way, the company that we bought, I didn't say, is Avere System, so we'll have that coming out soon on Azure.
I think we have just a few more minutes, so I will. I have two more questions, and then maybe we can have you guys give a few key takeaways. Security has not come up today, like either from anyone there or for me, or even your discussion. So, same question, but security. Like security is probably, you said business critical, things that will end your company. Security is probably one of them. Some companies have not ended yet, anyway, it is highly critical. So when you think about infrastructure, when you think about development, when you think about security, what are some thoughts and approaches that you would recommend?
You're pretty excited.
I'm excited.
You're pretty excited.
This is like in our wheelhouse. So we have a lot of customers who use Cloud Foundry primarily because they think of it as a change in security mindset. And our chief product security officer, Justin Smith, talks a lot about what we call the three R's: rotate, repave, repair. And this is as radical as it gets in security. So I'll give it a specific example. There's a very large bank, uses a lot of Cloud Foundry globally, dozens of data centers, use of public cloud in some of them. And they rebuild tens of thousands of containers with hundreds of VMs, thousands of VMs underneath them once a week in the middle of the day on Thursdays so they can map up any CVEs that have come up, even low severity CVEs in the last week. It takes cloud infrastructure and automation, to your point, to make that possible, right? So if, and this is back in this thought of like, software is a river and not a pond. We were doing a briefing yesterday with a customer who was saying, we sometimes just have code we just want to deploy and never think about again. I was like, no, you actually need to be very easily able to rebuild and redeploy that at any moment, because that is how you mop up security problems, right? That's everything from the operating system up has vulnerabilities in it. And it's not that your developer did a bad job with their little piece on the top, but you have so many layers of middleware and languages and frameworks and pulled in libraries and dependencies as well as the OS, all of that has to get updated. The flexibility of what containers and networking give you is that you can do that without turning the app off, right? You can have traffic routed to a new version while the old version is torn down, and you can use the elasticity of that infrastructure in order to take advantage of that. But you have to take advantage of it. It's not a thing that magically happens. So there are now such good best practices, and I think it's almost universally acknowledged that public cloud providers do a better job in terms of security of the underlying infrastructure than anybody else does. It's just a lame excuse to say, let's keep it in our data center because it's more safe, right? And we see this everything from spy agencies to militaries to giant aerospace company. Everybody is shifting their security mindset to say, well, Microsoft does it better than we do. Why would we keep doing it for ourselves? That's just hubris for us to think we're going to do better, because they have more people, more eyeballs, more attention, more lessons learned, and they just have a larger strike surface. Everybody in the world attacks Azure.
Yeah, I think we're all glad to see that people are coming to, they're understanding reality and that Microsoft and other cloud vendors can do it better. I'd say from Bitnami's perspective, we look a lot at provenance, and that's kind of how we look at solving the problem, is where are your bits coming from, and do you have a way to track them all the way through to your app and then keep them updated? And we did actually just launch a tool on Azure yesterday, Stacksmith, that's entirely focused on taking you from the base level upstream dependencies all the way through to packaging your app up for Azure, for containers, and helping you get that, you know, deployment ready assets, whether it's an ARM template or a Helm chart and a set of containers or the other formats that we support. But not only that, going to Josh's point, it lets you know whenever anything that you've put into that image is vulnerable to a CVE, and thanks to automation, you can automatically rebuild and redeploy that. And like you said, in containers, you can do it oftentimes without taking your app down. But to us, it's really about understanding what's going into your app at the time that you're actually like assembling the stack together, as opposed to kind of the virus scanning approach to security, which is like after stuff is deployed, going back and looking at what's there instead of making sure that the bits that are going into your deployment are secure from the start, and that you know what's in there, and that you have a really good way to automatically update it. So you don't just get this red flag, hey, we've got a security vulnerability, and then you've got to go figure out how to actually update that. And that's why, like you said, you need to know how to rebuild this stuff. Like, you can never just have an app, maybe if you're not on a network at all, but the most of us don't have that. I don't know if I'd call it luxury, but most of us aren't in that situation. So you have to be realistic about realizing that, you know, software does become vulnerable over time, and you need to have a way to address that.
Any other comments? All right, I have one last question, and this is your last time to come to the mics if you have any questions that you want to stump the panel with. Migration. I will tell you, in my job, one of the first things I get asked about is migration. People want to migrate. People want to migrate applications. And a lot of these applications are monolithic applications, right? Built on on-prem servers, they want to move to the cloud. I'm going to ask a slightly different question. Everyone here probably understands migration. What's one pitfall you've seen with migration planning? What's one thing to be aware of with migration planning?
So I think one thing I'd say is that a lot of the messaging out there in the market right now is around this concept of lift and shift, which is like, let's just take our VM and move it in the cloud. And that might do you some good if you have a mandate to, like, if you're losing your infrastructure, great. Like, that might be good. There might be other advantages to it, but it doesn't really let you take advantage of all the other underlying cloud services. And so we like to think instead about replatforming, which we think is a happy medium between, like, okay, take your app and completely re-architect it, which would be amazing, but most people don't have the luxury of the time and resources to rewrite everything when they want to move it in the cloud. So we like to think about, like, what can you do to move your app over and take advantage of some of the underlying services without having to re-architect everything? And that might mean just taking the app and some build scripts and then using, there's a bunch of tooling out there in addition to ours to help you move it over to the cloud and still be able to hook into things and take advantage of things like Cosmos DB without rebuilding the whole thing and without just simply slapping a VM from one place to another, which doesn't really help you that much.
We use exactly the same term, replatforming or refactoring, where refactoring is typically the you're going farther to the right, you're going more towards a 12-factor cloud-native application. A replatforming is maybe you get to 4 factors. You get it down so each container has one process and one port in it, but you haven't cleanly separated code and config, you're not breaking it down into microservices, but you're still getting some benefit. You're still starting to use service brokers. I'd say the two gotchas, one of them is people don't think through the data services side. So they say, oh, if you're going to break an app up even into 2 pieces and move it into cloud, or as soon as you have a network hop that's a cloud network hop and not a local LAN network hop, or you're using cloud storage, which really just has different performance characteristics than your SAN, you're going to need caching. You're going to go in and say, oh, yeah, I should be thinking about where am I caching this? And is it read side? Is it write side? Is that part of the app architecture? And does it need to be? The second thing, and probably the last point on this, is almost every customer we see who has a migration plan brings in a consultant who writes a binder, right? So the migration plan starts out with a binder, which is a waste of money and time. It goes on a shelf. That's where binders go. What works is when people start by doing. Rather than saying, look, you're not going to look at a portfolio of 3,000 applications and come up with a perfect plan without trying anything. That has never been true in software ever. What will be true is do 5. 2 of them will fail. 2 of them will be reasonably successful. 1 of them will work super well. And then figure out what was different about that one project and do 10 more like that. And then you can pick up some speed. And then we see folks naturally hockey stick of, oh, we did the first 5, and then we did 10, and we did 300 in the next 6 months afterwards. Because the patterns fall out. And you say, okay, well, here's where we put a cache, and here's where we use these tools, and here's our build scripts. The team gets good at it. The first one took a week. The second one takes a half day, right? And then you pick up momentum. But the binder thing just makes me crazy because I show up, I was like, oh, and I'm not going to, you know, the classic, it's usually the big accountant vendors who come in like, yeah, we'll do an app transformation review portfolio assessment for you, and here's a binder. I was like, throw the binder out.
Yeah, I'll just add one thing. I think the biggest thing is tests. I mean, I think the test before you move is one of the biggest, I think, pitfalls. Just make sure that things work the way you expect them to, and particularly on the networking side. Networking is very challenging no matter where in the stack you're moving, what services you're moving to. Make sure you think through your networking strategy pretty deliberately.
Corey, since you have the mic, or Tad, we just have a minute. Any final words you guys want to share with the audience?
Good luck.
Thank you for having us. thank you. It's great. I think talking about infrastructure in the context of modern developer scenarios, that's pretty cool stuff. So, and thank you too, by the way, also.
Thank you. I think I said this before, but I'll say it again. There are so many amazing new services coming out there. I think it's important to get out there and try them and build some things. Like you said, start with doing, right? Like just try to start building. There's an amazing number of tutorials and great resources out there. But then when you're ready to build the app, consider why you're doing it and think through the business value and the ongoing maintenance costs from a human perspective, and then make smart choices based on your actual business needs and not just building new shiny things.
Be kind to yourself. There's this entire expo is like a tribute to FOMO, right? You walk through the floor and you're like, hey, even the people who work on Azure and run Azure don't know about all the Azure services. You are never going to. You don't need to. If it's like that North Star of like, I have a project, I have a problem I'm trying to solve, focus on what you need for that problem. Don't try and become a master in everything available in public cloud. Like, it's going to change tomorrow anyway. Also, they'll rename everything. But yeah, just be kind of like, avoid the FOMO feelings. It's fine to not know what's going on.
Yeah, and just by listening to this panel, I think it was learn about the business requirement, try, and then go do would be my kind of takeaway.
Push
Thank you, Josh, Erica, Tad, and Corey. Thanks, everyone.